From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Nanfu Wang first left China to come to school here in the U.S., she had never seen a documentary film, not one. So it's even more remarkable that her first film made it into Sundance this year, and it was a documentary. It's a really powerful piece of do-it-yourself filmmaking. She had to constantly hide her camera and her footage from various Chinese government officials. Wang follows an outspoken women's rights activist, a brave and provocative woman named Yi Haiyan. The film is about her. It's called Hooligan Sparrow. That's her nickname. Today in the program, Nanfu Wang is joining us to talk about her thrilling and really kind of frightening summer with Hooligan Sparrow. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary film Hooligan Sparrow. It's a profile of this remarkable woman and activist in China who has found these provocative ways to get attention for her causes. Causes like women's rights and the exploitation of children and the plight of the country's sex workers. Her name is Yi Haiyan, but she's known as Hooligan Sparrow. She uses nudity and blunt language in her social media and street protests. Nanfu Wang went to China to meet her, and as soon as she did, she changed the focus of the film she wanted to make. Rather than a story on sex work in China, she wanted to tell the story of the sparrow. As you can probably imagine, making a film in China about an outspoken activist required some creativity, like hidden cameras, and in this scene, a hidden microphone, as Nanfu Wang prepares to meet with Chinese security officials.
Today is August 19th. This afternoon, I'm going to meet with the national security agents who will come to see me at 3 o'clock and investigate on what I've been doing during this summer. I'm a little bit nervous. I really wish I can film the conversation, but of course I couldn't. There's no way to even take out a camera. So what I did is I put on this long dress. You can see this is an ankle length dress. And underneath the dress, I put on my shorts. And I have my audio recorder in my pocket. Hopefully, I can get the audio of our conversation.
You said you were nervous.
Yes.
Were you scared?
Super nervous.
Were you scared?
Yes, I was. That was the last day of filming. And during the several months that I was filming, the national security agents had contacted and interrogated my family and my friends. So when I returned home, I knew they were coming for me.
Yeah.
And so every day I was super nervous and scared, didn't know when they would come and once they come, what they would do. And I remember the night before, I just didn't know what to do. Mm. I was playing in my head what questions they might ask me. How should I answer? How much truth should I tell? Mm-hmm. Would I be arrested? How much did they already know?
At first, this was going to be kind of a different film. You had something else in mind. You were going to focus on sex workers in China. But at some point, everything shifts to this remarkable woman, Yi Haiyan, mm-hmm. Sparrow. When did it change? When did you decide the film is about her? At least that's what I want to focus on for this film.
Well, I was in New York when I started thinking about making a film in China. I was a graduate student at the time at NYU. And I'd been researching about sex workers' rights for months. I personally was interested in that. And then I learned Sparrow, she offered free sex to migrant workers in China,
yeah.
Which is her campaign called Free Sex Campaign. And I thought she's such a brave woman who would offer sex to strangers for free. So I contacted her from New York asking, would you be willing to meet me and introduce me to some of the sex workers that you worked with?
Yeah.
And she said, sure. Why don't you come back to China and we'll meet and talk? And in May 2013, I went back to China. And the first thing I did was calling her and asking, hey, I'm back. Can we meet? And she said, well, I'm not at home. And I asked, where are you then? And she said, I cannot tell you. And she's been very secretive and evasive. So it made me really curious what exactly she was doing and why she was reluctant to tell me. And I kept calling her. And eventually, we met for the first time in a different city rather than her home city.
Yeah.
And when I first met her, I learned that the reason she was so secretive was because she and a group of activists were planning for protest against a rape case in China at the time. And that's why she couldn't talk on the phone, because the phone was monitored.
Yeah. We'll talk about that particular case, obviously, because it's central to the film. But that's the thing that made you realize maybe this is the story I should tell, was this story, this sort of sex abuse, bigger story, and follow her around, I guess. That's when it shifted for you?
Yeah. So when she told me that she was planning about the protest, and that was a rape case that I had heard since I returned to China. It was the breaking news. It was all over the news, all over the paper. And everybody was talking about it on social media. It was six young girls aged between 11 and 14 got raped by their principal and another government official. And there was huge controversy that people were blaming the girls for going to the hotel room with the principal. And there were also media spinning the story, saying that the girls were paid, the principal gave them a gift, give them money. So it was a huge debate. Mm-hmm. Whose fault is that, or whether it's rape or not, whether it's even sexual abuse or not, or it's child prostitution, which, because the Chinese law allows that any sex offenders to get away from rape by proving that they paid their victims,
Then
it would be a prostitution case.
Because if you're convicted of rape, it's like a lot of prison or possible capital punishment. But if it's child prostitution, the punishment is significantly less. So the idea is, then you say, well, as long as you say, no, I paid for it, that makes a difference. And so,
Yeah, so when I learned that they were doing the protest and their goal was to educate the public, no matter what, these are young girls, it should be sexual abuse, it should be rape, and the law should be repealed, because that's most powerful offenders got away. And when I was reading the news, I believed the story is much deeper, and I wanted to know the inside story myself. So I immediately said to them, I wanted to go to the protest with you.
Talk a little bit about Sparrow, who she is. It's interesting, she uses nudity in her activism. She has this kind of in-your-face sort of provocative sensibility. I mean, she's very militant in terms of her, support for women's rights, those kinds of things. How do you describe the work that she does? Because it's almost like performance art
ways. That's how I would say it, actually. She's very unique in terms the way that she does activism. A lot of human rights activists, their work probably, is human rights. Mm-hmm. But she makes it much relatable and much fun, because she's almost like a performance artist. I would sometimes compare her, when I describe her to my friends, she's like the Chinese version of Marina Abramović, who does that kind of work.
Yeah.
And I first got to know her was through social media, because she was very prominent on social media. She has 70,000 followers on Twitter, given that Twitter was banned in China. Mm-hmm. And she would post her nude photos with signs that has messages about women's rights written on it, covering her private parts. And when I asked her, why did you do that? And she was like, because I know if you hold up a sign and stand up on the streets, nobody would pay attention.
Right.
But if I post a nude photo with a sign on my boob, then people would see it. They probably at the beginning would only see the nude pictures. But then as I post more and more and more and more, they would get sick of my body and they would start paying attention to the message.
Mm. Let me play another moment from the film because I want to ask you about it.
It was my first trip back home to China after living in America for 2 years. I had never met Sparrow, but I knew, like me, she came from a poor farming village and had a hard life.
This is an interesting part of the story, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about your relationship or your connection anyway to Sparrow. You yourself came from a small village. Your parents were farmers, also worked part-time, I guess, teaching as well. But this is they came from a rural environment. She came from a rural environment. She was an activist. You sort of became an activist. Talk about your connection, your relationship, because you must have related with her in that way.
Yeah. At the beginning, I noticed her what drew my attention was her campaigns. But then as I did more research on her, I learned her background, I learned her life experience, and it's quite similar to mine because I was born in a village and so did her. And my parents, they were, you know, they worked as elementary school teachers part-time. And when I was 12, my father passed away.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, my family had huge hospital bill, and my mom had debt. She couldn't afford me to go to school anymore, so I had to work.
Yeah.
And I got my first job when I was 16, and I have a younger brother because my mom said, you have to work, you have to support the family. Your younger brother has to go to school, go to university. He was 8 at the time, and he has a long way to go. And you, as a girl, education is not that important. So we have to, if we have to sacrifice one, then it would be me.
Yeah.
And Sparrow, she has a very similar background. She is the oldest among all her siblings. She has 2 younger brothers. And she quit school after middle school. And she did numerous different kinds of jobs, factory girl, you know, witches, all kinds, like migrant workers. And it's that experience made her more empathize with more people like her who live at the bottom of the society.
Yeah. There's this moment in the film where she goes back home to, she's basically going from one place to another, being evicted and sort of chased away. And we'll get to that as we go. But she ends up back at the sort of family village. And she says this thing. She says that she only shows her parents, particularly her mother, the simple side of her, like any other peasant woman, she says. And she says the only connection between us is about survival. And you yourself have talked about how you and your mother have a, it seems to me anyway, a similar kind of relationship, that you don't talk about the activism. You only talk about the essentials. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I think, I don't know if it's a Chinese culture thing, but I completely understood Sparrow. She didn't tell her parents or even other family members anything she did.
Yeah.
She didn't tell them that she was evicted, she was arrested, she had gone through so much. And the reason was because she didn't want them to worry. And they couldn't understand. For her parents, the word activism is not a familiar word. They had spending their entire life trying to survive, trying to make money to get enough food, and they couldn't have that conversation. And for me, it's similar, unfortunately. I love my mom and we have a great relationship. We talk, even though now I live in the US and she lives in China, and we talk every week. But all our conversations are about, how was your life?
Yeah.
Are you healthy? How was your, you know, it's nothing about. And when I first chose documentary as my career, my mom did not know what documentary was.
Hmm.
I had to explain to her. And even till today, most of people like her in China, they have not seen a single documentary. And my mom, I think she hasn't been to a movie theater in her entire life.
Wow.
So it's really hard to talk. And when I returned to China and was making this film, I did not tell her that I was making a film. And I certainly didn't tell her now that the film is out and there will be consequences, because I don't want her to be freaked out. Yeah.
Your father taught you to think independently. and there's this Chinese folk tale, Little Horse Crossing the River. It's actually the name of your production company now. That seems to be meaningful to the way you think about the world. Would you mention it?
It's a story I remembered my dad told me when I was probably 7 or 8. And it was a child's story. So the story goes, there was a little horse who lives by his mom by the river, and the horse had never crossed the river in his life. And one day, the mother horse said to the little horse, "Would you mind going across the river to do some errands for me?" And the little horse said, "Sure, Mom, I would do it." And then he ran to the river, and when he was about to cross the river, there was a squirrel in a tree yelled at him, "Little horse, be careful, you shouldn't do it. You would be drowned. My brother died in the river. It's so deep." And the little horse stepped back and was hesitant whether he should cross or not. Then there was a buffalo said to him, "Well, it's really shallow, the water. It's just by the level of my ankle. You should totally go cross it." And the little horse looked at both and didn't know what to do. He went back to his mom and asked, "They all said different things. I don't know who to believe." And then the mom told the little horse, which is also my dad told me, mm-hmm. and he was like, "In your life, you would hear people's advice, but those advice are all based on their own experience. And you don't know whether it would apply to you until you really try yourself." And for me, growing up, as I mentioned, that me and my mom didn't talk much besides food. There were times that I had to make decisions that I thought was really important, which school to go to, which career to choose, things like that, whether to go to the U.S. or not. I was really torn at many moments, didn't know which is the right decision. And every time when I had to make the decision, I thought about the story, "I have to try, then I would know." Although I could ask so many people's opinions, but still, eventually I would only know when I try it myself. And that's the experience of making Hooligan's Barrel. Mm-hmm. It's my first film. And at every stage, there were decisions to make, there were debates, and I had to try it.
Nanfu Wong. She directed, produced, shot, and edited the documentary film Hooligan Sparrow, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. You can see it next Tuesday night. It's going to be showing on the PBS program POV here in Utah. It's at 11 o'clock, though if you can, you should DVR it. It's worth it. You can find out more about that and find listings in your area on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary film Hooligan Sparrow. It's about a brave and outrageous women's rights activist. Her name is Yi Haiyan. She's known as Hooligan Sparrow. The filmmaker Nanfu Wong is our guest. She spent a thrilling and in some cases terrifying summer with Sparrow, trying to hide her camera, trying to keep her footage from being confiscated. She did manage to make a film, which premiered at Sundance this year. We're talking about it today. It's called Hooligan Sparrow. Let's go back to Hainan province. This is in the it's an island province in the most southern part of the country. And this is where this sex abuse story is playing out. You follow Sparrow there to see this. And I want to play a clip. This is in Chinese, but we'll get a sense, and I want you to maybe talk us through this. This is Sparrow and this little handful of activists who are going to go to this outside of the school and protest. And what's interesting about the clip is basically in this moment here, Sparrow is training them to chant these kind of provocative things. And show these signs that are kind of provocative. And one of them is, hey, principal, get a room with me, leave the kids alone. Another sort of typical provocative thing that she says. Let's play a moment of this, and maybe you can talk about this sort of training moment.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about what's happening here. Basically, she's teaching these people how to protest, I guess, in some way.
It was interesting. That was before we went to the protest, and they had a meeting. They want to strategize everything. So it was actually a very democratic moment because she was suggesting some slogans they should shout out in front of the school. And they were voting.
Yeah.
So actually she was saying, how about this one?
Right.
Punish the principal, purify the campers. And how many people agree? If you agree, like, raise up your hand. And then people would vote. And they had decided several slogans that way. And then eventually she said, I would have my slogan. I would say the line, get a room with me and leave the kids alone.
Yeah.
And everybody was laughing, and I was laughing, because who would think to do a protest using that line? And it's so typical Hogan Sparrow.
So typical. She's so funny.
Yeah, she has a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
And she's very creative, I had to say.
Yeah. So how did you see your role? Because, I mean, on one hand, maybe you thought, oh, I'm just here to document what's happening. Or did you also think, no, I want to be involved in some way, because she asks you, for example, to film things. Sparrow says, why don't you film these things? Did you ever think, well, that's not really my role. I'm just here to document what you're doing.
Not really. I think it's a yes and no.
Hmm.
I did. I was there to document everything I could. And I never thought that I wouldn't participate in the protest. I would never go and join them and shout the slogans. But when she asked me to film, that was a very special case because she wanted help. She wanted me to film these testimonies of the activist saying that they wouldn't commit suicide. And I, at the beginning, didn't understand until the lawyer explained to me. When the activists go to protests in China, because it was such a taboo to do a protest, usually the risk is really high that they would get detained or sometimes simply they disappeared and nobody knew where they were until days, months later, and they would be found dead. And the government would issue an announcement saying that those people committed suicide. And in order to avoid those risks, the activists wanted to protect themselves by doing a testimony video, which they would say, I won't commit suicide. My name is this, and I'm going to do this. And if anything happened to me, you will find this video online, and you would know that I didn't commit suicide.
So the stakes are pretty real. There were a lot of risks involved. Do you think Americans understand that?
No.
Yeah, really?
No.
Yeah.
And if you see the film, and I think if you don't know the context of it, people would find it shocking. There were only 9 people protesting.
Yeah.
It's such a small protest. But the truth is, Chinese government doesn't allow protest. And I lived in China for 24 years. And I had not seen a single protest in my life. That was the first one.
Wow.
And I believe most Chinese people still haven't seen a single protest in their life. So I guess for American audience, when they see that, they would find it some kind of like absurdity in there.
It's totally absurd. Yeah. It seems crazy because then there you are, they're protesting, you're shooting this. Mm-hmm. And people are, they find it strange that you're shooting this in the first place, that you're taping it. And so people are oddly looking at you as they go by. And it seems to go so much against the grain of the culture. You say also that it would take you weeks to realize who it was that was watching you at that protest. Say something about that.
It was quite overwhelming at the protest because we were afraid that the police would show up. We were concerned whether we would be arrested. And at the same time, because the protest happened in front of the school and a lot of school students came out, a lot of parents were there, mm-hmm. and a lot of bystanders, a lot. And you just look at so many people, and I was trying to film as much as I can, trying to film different angles, different people. And I didn't, there were people also asking me questions, mm-hmm. or some of them even filming me, taking pictures of me. And I did not know when I was there who they are and why they did it. Until later, when we went back that day, the activist and lawyers were saying, oh, did you see that guy? He was secret police. Did you see that guy who was secret police officer? And I was shocked because I did not see it. I had zero experience participating in a protest. Mm. And I wasn't political before I made this film. So I did not know those things.
Yeah. It made me wonder in some ways how much of this was the government reacting to the actual charges, you know, that these protesters mm-hmm. were saying that this was about sex bribes and corruption, how much it was about that and how much it was just about the audacity of these people to dare to do a protest, which was so taboo in that culture.
We thought about this and we questioned, we discussed all the time. By we, I mean me, Sparrow, and some other activists. Because at first we thought, oh, the government was trying to cover up the crime in Hainan province because probably they felt it was so negative and it's shameful mm-hmm. to expose it. And then as we went to different provinces, and especially when I traveled too, the government not only interrogated the activists, they also went to different places. It was across the country to interrogate my family and my friends and who were in different places.
Yeah.
And no matter where we went, whether it's 1,000 miles away or 500 miles away, the same thing would happen, that we would be followed and interrogated. And that started making me think, or, you know, making us question, this is not as simple as the one crime. It's about protest. It's about speaking out. It's about telling the stories. It's those things that the government didn't want us to do. They didn't want me to show the footage. They didn't want me to tell the stories.
I want to ask you about a really powerful character, another one in the story, aside from Sparrow. And this is Wang Yu.
Yeah.
She's a human rights lawyer. Seems like a really remarkable human being. Would you say something about her? She offers refuge for people who want to speak out. This idea of telling these stories, speaking out, is really important to her.
Yeah. She's one of my favorite people. She is a human rights lawyer, and there are not so many female human rights lawyers in China. There are not so many human rights lawyers in China anyway, and female is even fewer. And I was amazed how brave she was, because during the time that we were doing the protest, and later when Sparrow was detained, which then Wang Yu became Sparrow's lawyer to defend her, and she sued the government for illegally detaining Sparrow.
Yeah.
And she's been doing cases like that for years. And her life would be traveling from one place to another to defend the most sensitive cases. And she had faced threats, being beaten by secret police. And she was still doing it. And many times that when I was there, I asked her, "Are you not afraid?" And she always say, "Yes, I am afraid, but I'm more afraid what the country would be like if nobody stood up and fight. If nobody stood up and fought." And when I came back and started editing the film in 2015, she was arrested. It was about a year and a month ago. She is still in jail. And she was formally charged with subverting the government. And that's a sentence, that's a charge that could give her a sentence from 15 years to life in jail.
Well, I want to ask you about, there's a moment that you capture all of these moments. And it's interesting how, in this particular case, we'll hear Sparrow being essentially attacked by thugs. I mean, and she records this, I think, on her phone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of that. There's this sort of these moments when, thankfully, she has a phone and she's able to capture these confrontations she has with these thugs. And I want to talk about the thugs themselves, but let me give people a sense of just how much commotion she has to endure.
你们去27号。现在有5个妇女在外面，他们在这里骚扰我，那我已经到我家里来了。哦，他们现在正好就在外头给你骚扰你呢，是吗？对，他们现在已经在我家里故意二三四五六七，在打我，在打我，他们。哎，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，快点，
important part of the film. We see these a lot of commotion because of all of this.
Yeah, so what happened was she wasn't arrested at the protest, and we all felt so lucky. Mm-hmm. We even thought, oh, maybe the Chinese government is improving, that they wouldn't arrest the protesters. And Sparrow returned home the next day, which was about 500 or 600 miles away from the protest. And she got home around 2 a.m. And by 9 a.m., a group of people came and they beat her. And it was interesting. And then she started defending herself because those people broke into her house and was threatening her. And when she was defending herself, the police showed up and arrested her and charged her for assaulting two people who broke into her house. And that was very bizarre to all of us. And those people, they were the brothel owners that once Sparrow worked at when she was doing the free sex campaign. But that was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And during the past 2 years, nothing happened. She worked at the brothels 2 years ago. And now 2 years later, the same day as she returned from the protest, the brothel owners showed up and accused her for working at the brothel, for exposing the sex workers' living conditions, for bringing the attention and the media attention to the brothels. But we just thought the timing was so bizarre.
These crowds of people, of thugs, basically, who show up. And this happens from time to time. She gets evicted. She ends up in a certain place. And then the next day or later that day, there are these crowds that appear on the street outside trying to get in or whatever. And I'm wondering, who are these? Because you say that in some way that they seem to be paid by the government. That, I mean, who are they? Who are these crowds?
That's something bothered me so much when I was there. I asked the exact same question. The day when Sparrow returned home from the detention center, there were about 30 people, 30 guys showed up in front of her house and threatening to, you know, to beat her and demanding her to leave the city. And they all look like just ordinary people, you and I. And I looked at them and I was so surprised, and also I just couldn't understand why they were there, and because Spare was defending their rights and she was helping them, but those people that she tried to support kind of turned against her. You know, they even made up official signs to hand them on the streets, which said, "Sparrow, you whore, get out of the city."
Yeah.
And then I was told that this was very common as one of the tactics the government uses pretty often against the activists. And what I also learned is the government have this informal team called Maintaining Stability Team, and it's not official. But the budget, well, this is like what I learned from the activists, and I don't have the statistics. But one saying is the budget of the government using on the maintaining stability in China is even larger than the military budget.
Wow.
So
that's saying something.
Yeah. So what usually happens is ordinary people would get paid as a part-time job. Say you want to get paid 100 yuan a day to do this, and then a lot of people would do it.
That's Nanfu Wong, who directed and produced and shot and edited the documentary film Hooligan Sparrow, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. You'll be able to see it next Tuesday evening. It's going to be showing on the PBS program POV. Here in Utah, it's at 11 o'clock. That's 11 o'clock at night on KUED Channel 7. You can find out more about that and find listings in your area on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Nanfu Wong about her documentary film, Hooligan Sparrow.
Let me play another moment from the film. This is a fellow you're talking to who claims to be a fellow protester. And he's suggesting that you should probably leave. Let me play a little bit of this. He's speaking in Chinese, so most of us won't be able to understand it. But this is such an interesting moment. I wanted you to talk a little bit about it. So he's telling you that he thinks you should probably leave. And then he says to you, "You should probably give me your hard drive with all of your information, and I'll give it to you a little bit later." What did you know about him? He seemed like an incredibly shady guy.
I did not know much about him. And, you know, during Sparrow's arrest, I was staying at her apartment with her daughter. And every day there were just so many activists coming from all over the country to show their support. The activists in China, they are isolated in terms of they don't have a lot of access to information, and it's really difficult for them to do activism. But among the activists, the community is really united. If one activist was arrested, the rest, they would either donate money to them or just travel to visit to support. So there were a lot of activists coming, and I did not know any of them. And also, I did not know who is who. And because the government would pay ordinary people to monitor their neighbors, other activists, there were cases that they also paid some activists to monitor, to report their fellow activists' behavior.
Yeah.
Like if they had a meeting, there would be one activist probably would report that to the police. So at the time, I did not know who to trust, and I did not know who's doing what.
Yeah.
And some activists that I really trusted, including Wang Yu, the lawyer, she would advise me saying that, well, you probably should make up a story saying that you are a college student, you are here doing an internship, or you are here just visiting, and don't tell them the truth that you are making a documentary film, you are from the U.S., or don't even use your real name. Mm-hmm. Make up a nickname, a fake name.
Well, part of what you do in the film is document your own sense of paranoia. I mean, there's this scene where you go to Shanghai and you realize the police are looking for you. You have to protect your footage. You have to stay at the office of a friend. And then there's another moment. I want to play this moment because it's kind of harrowing. There's this scene where Yi is Sparrow. She has managed to get a private apartment.
Yeah.
But then there's this crowd that is gathered outside. They know that you're coming, and you're having to basically run up the stairs. Let me play a little bit of this, and maybe you can tell me what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us what's happening.
Yeah, that moment, every time I watch it, I got so emotional. It was one night. It was after Sparrow got evicted from an apartment. So the eviction of that eviction was, yeah, every time I hear this part and I watch this part, it was just so reminding me all the emotions I had at the moment. So Sparrow got evicted and she moved to a new city. And in that new city, and she settled down, she rented a new apartment and she wanted to start a new life. One night, around midnight, there were six police officers in plain clothes and uniformed, went into her apartment and moved everything, all the furniture, all her belongings, moved out into a van and forced them to get into the van, basically kidnapped them.
Yeah.
And drove 100 miles along the highway to the middle of nowhere and dumped them along with everything they have. All the clothes, even refrigerator.
And there's a photograph of this we should mention, and it becomes part of an art exhibit.
Yeah.
Of Ai Weiwei. Say something about this photograph. It's just her sitting in the middle of nowhere with all of her possessions that she existed, that she had at the time.
Yeah. So she took a picture of herself sitting along the highway and had everything she owned. And she posted this picture on Twitter, and her friend Ai Weiwei saw it. So Ai Weiwei called her immediately asking what happened, and she told the story. And Ai Weiwei said, well, why don't you ship all the belongings to my studio in Beijing, and I'll pay for the shipping fee. And Sparrow was really happy that that could happen because she literally had no money and did not know what to do with those things. And she shipped all the belongings to the studio. And little did we know at the time that Ai Weiwei then spent another half year assembling all the belongings, taking all the clothes out of the suitcases, and took a picture of each item and then put them back and then made it an exhibition, and it toured around the world. But that was the story. After, And what happened after Sparrow shipped the belongings to Ai Weiwei, she now needed to find a place to stay that night. Mm-hmm. And her friend, who was in Guangzhou City, and said to her, my apartment is available. I can give you the keys. It's empty. You can stay there. And me and Sparrow and her daughter and two other activists, that night around midnight, we went to that apartment. But when we got close to the building, there were already people waiting for us. Some of them were uniform, some of them plain clothes. And then they just said, you cannot stay here. If you stay here, we will arrest you. And I don't know who started, but then we just run upstairs. We almost feel that as long as we can get into the apartment, lock the door, then they wouldn't be able to do something. Then they would be safe. So me and Sparrow's daughter were running kind of ahead of everybody. And Huang was the last one. And he got caught. And they were beating him. And the yelling that you heard from that clip was him yelling, help. And Sparrow heard that. And Sparrow said, I have to go back. I have to go downstairs to help him. I cannot leave him there. And she went back. And Sparrow's boyfriend also went back. And he opened the door for me and Sparrow's daughter. And then he locked it from outside and he went back. So three of them were arrested that night, leaving me and Sparrow's daughter in the apartment. The entire night, we were so scared. We turned off the light quickly. We were afraid that they could see from outside. But then there were people knocking at the door all the time. And we were just so afraid, didn't know if they would break in or when they would break in. And the next morning, we woke up and we looked down the window. There were about five or six secret police still like watching us take turns. None of them had left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about the reaction to the film since you've finished it. This is kind of disappointing, I have to say. You've talked about how some of your friends back in China who had heard about it, I guess, thought that you'd become too extreme now, that you've been too influenced by Western culture. How are they reacting to this film, this story?
Yeah, that's very frustrating. I had a lot. Well, some of my best friends in my life are still in China, most of them, because I only came here in 2011. And most of my friends do not watch documentaries. Most of my friends do not have access. They don't have access to Google, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, anything. Mm. So all the information they got was from the government. And they read the articles depicting Sparrow as a prostitute. We read the articles depicting lawyer Wang Yu as a criminal who uses money from foreign countries to subvert the Chinese government. And they read so much, all kinds of textbooks, newspaper, saying how foreign forces were trying to sabotage Chinese government. Mm. And when I told them my experience and the film, I'm sure they believed me, but then they always say, it was almost, most people would say, well, I think it must be the local government. If you see something wrong from the local government, all you should do is to report to the upper level government, and you shouldn't expose the story outside of China because you would create a negative image of China, which is our mother country, and we all should protect the image of our country. And we won't be proud of being Chinese. We want other people admire Chinese, not look down upon Chinese. And then it's really hard to argue that, well, the government and the country, they are two different things.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah, but and then a lot of my friends will say, what had changed you? You've gone, you lived in the U.S. For 5 years, and now you have all changed. Yeah. You became so extreme, you are so biased. It just reconfirmed that what the government says, that the Western culture is all about shaming Chinese government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you, will you go back to China?
I don't know if I can. It's unpredictable, and that's the most difficult thing with the Chinese authority, because they don't have a blacklist that I can check online if I am on the list or not.
Right.
Yeah. And I wish I could. I have my entire family still in China, and it's a place, well, I was born and I grew up, and I had, it's a place that created me, created who I am. So I wish I could go back. And there are so many stories in China I wanted to tell.
Nanfu Wang. Her film is called Hooligan Sparrow. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.